Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Crossover. Starring Josh Johnson and Chris McGill. Featuring Christina Thorson. And of course, you, the Instagram live chat. Now, sit back and enjoy this week's edition of The Crossover. Powered by Card Ladder.
All right. Welcome, everybody. Today is April 5th, Friday, and you're watching Crossover, and we start this show with announcements and mail days. I'm going to go in a different order this time and let us do announcements first if we have any of those. Do we have any announcements? No? I don't think so.
The sales.
Hashtag Weird Sammy.
Sales volume is up.
Sales volume is up.
Like, yeah. A lot. Isn't it like 245?
The sales volume from the industry tab on Card Ladder in March of 2024 was 225 million.
Nice.
That's the largest sales volume month since August of 2022.
It's not 10x.
Not bad.
It's not 10x, but we're working on it.
Yeah. 1.1x. We'll take that.
I don't have any other announcements, and I don't have any mail days.
No mail days. All right. And hashtag where's Sammy?
Sleeping.
Yeah.
He, at the end of these weeks, he gets tired from school, so he's tired.
It's understandable. All right. Let's get on to the questions then. We've got quite a few. Gage.
He says when, not if.
Yeah. All right. Let's get on to some questions here because we've got quite a few this week. First one up, very topical, from Yeah Man Cards. What do you guys think about March Madness this year, especially the women's side? Do you think this is a positive for the hobby? Is it sustainable?
I don't know that there's ever been, like, hobby value coming out of March Madness, right? Like, all the best March Madness names and players, like, none of that translates to card values, I don't think.
Doesn't come on my radar yet, because those are, none of those athletes have reached the professional level, and I've yet to begin collecting an athlete who's at the pre-professional level. And there's lots of importance to, you know, the rookie season and the cards that accompany the rookie season at the professional level. So
yeah, those.
But with that said, like, Caitlin Clark cards sell pretty well.
I was gonna say, those Caitlin Clark autos that you sent me, that Panini post, those are pretty slick.
Yep, they are. Well, that bleeds into the next question here, which is from USMNT Soccer Cards. This has been. All right, what inning are we in for Caitlin Clark? I just love that the inning thing has been going on for like 4 to 5 years, I feel like.
Christina, who has the WNBA license for cards? How does that work exactly? Like, who makes WNBA cards?
It's currently Panini.
Yeah. And it will be Fanatics?
I don't believe Fanatics went after WNBA, to my knowledge.
And it's not, like, attached to the NBA or something like that?
I did not believe so, because they had their own Players Association and league license.
Mm.
But I could be wrong. Like, I don't follow it that closely. I don't collect WNBA cards. I only care about UConn women's basketball, which we all know. I've said it many times. So, I'm not happy tonight.
It would be cool to have some Caitlin Clark rookie cards. Is that the question?
We'll get those either way, because those will be next season. And even if the WNBA is part of the NBA package that transitions over to Fanatics, that still doesn't happen until 2025.
But, I mean, once Caitlin Clark goes to the WNBA, everyone's going to stop watching her. That's what I've been told. That's a take that I've heard. Isn't that what's going to happen? So should we even care?
it's a good question. I don't know.
Maybe the worst, one of the worst takes I've heard.
Yeah, I agree. I don't buy that take either, but I never doubt this hobby's ability to get unreasonably excited about a very trendy fad and then completely forget about it.
So that, you think that could happen when she gets the WBA?
I think that could happen a week from now.
Yeah.
Because what?
Well, she.
Championship game is Sunday, so.
She's presumably going to go to a bad team. So that might hurt some of her, some of the excitement around her.
All the teams bad, like, let's be honest.
One's got to win.
Yeah, relatively bad. Like the Fever have the first pick because they're bad, I would guess.
Yeah. Okay. So what inning are we in for Caitlin Clark? So there's so maybe some people say it's the ninth inning of Caitlin Clark, and some people say the second inning. Remember when Luger had the breakdown of like the people and the businesses and the market, and they're all in different innings?
Yeah.
Yeah. Caitlin Clark's collegiate career is in the ninth inning. WNBA career just getting started.
What if she's just Sabrina Ionescu with higher usage rate?
Yeah, we'll table that question for a later day.
That's a real question that I have, because I don't know anything about the women's game, but I know that they're, you know, they're like similar-ish college careers. Caitlin's is better.
Yeah,
I don't know. We'll see.
Well, you know, I love stats. I know you love stats too.
Her stats are amazing. I don't about it, but also like watching these games, like she's literally the only person on their team. Like she's doing everything.
Yeah. Well, here's some stats for you that I stumbled into the other day. The highest PER that's ever been recorded in an NBA season. Remember, PER is league average. All right. So it's PER. All these stats are dependent upon the league average player. How much better you are than the league average player.
Right.
The highest NBA.
So it's not. It's not like the pace of play dictates the rating or anything like that.
That's yep. It's pace adjusted as well.
Perfect.
But like, it also sets the league average player at 15 for PER. So like, PER is relative to the league average player. So yeah. When I'm about to give you Caitlin Clark's PER, it doesn't make sense to say, oh, her PER is better than Michael Jordan, so she's better than Michael Jordan. No, her PER is relative to her, the average player in college basketball.
Yes.
Okay, so the highest NBA PER is like 33, the highest season ever. Here are her PERs through her four seasons, I guess, at Iowa. 36.
What? 30, oh, wait, that's the first season?
35. Okay, oh. Sophomore, 35.
Sophomore slump.
Junior, 41. Senior, 44.
Oh, my God, I already know that that's like the highest ever of anything. That's so high.
And then you have box plus minus. I'll just do this into and then I'll stop. Her box plus, the highest NBA box plus minus is 13 point something. Okay, that's the highest NBA season ever, is like 13 point something. Her box plus minuses go 12.8, 13.4, 18.9.
Oh my God,
21.1.
Like literally she goes, well, college is like blowout central. Yeah. Like these games are somewhat blowouts.
Yeah, and the difference between the best player and the average player is huge. Like, and I remember just like looking up Keegan Murray's PER once when he was like being touted as a pick, and like his PER was like in the mid 30s. So like,
okay,
you know,
yeah,
the college thing is different. All right. But still I had never seen a PER at 44,
yeah,
or a box plus minus at 21. That was fun.
When you started at 36 her freshman year, and I hadn't heard of her until last year, I'm like, whoa, like she was already cooking long before I even heard of her.
Yeah. All right. Moving on here from Enjoy Cards Instagram. Just for fun, what would be each of your most fun outcomes to the NBA season and playoffs? And separately from that, what would be your most fun hobby outcomes to the NBA season playoffs? This is not what you think will happen, but what in your wildest but somewhat reasonable dreams would be really fun for you.
Outside of us just like picking our favorite teams?
I guess, yeah, I don't know. Take it how you will.
The most fun would just be watching the teams that I want to win win. And hobby outcomes would be LeBron winning. It's pretty obvious.
Yeah. Yep. Same. I'm on the same plane as that. I guess, but I'll add a third layer to this question, which is if I take away my personal bias and personal interest, then what's the most interesting?
Let's do that. So I'll take away Suns, Lakers, you take away Nuggets, Mavs.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep. All right. So then this question gets, I'll tell you what I don't want.
No, we'll do that second. Answer, let the question ask him, get his answer.
I want to pivot to the negative so bad right now.
That's like the story of our lives.
Yeah, it is. I don't know. Do you have one? I need to think for a second.
I have so much hate in my heart. But it's
all I can think about is the players who I don't want to win.
Well, I usually think about it in terms of, this is really selfish and horrible. You can tell how bad of a person I am. It's usually like, I want the team to win that has the least impact on like my personal, you know, like for example, if the Celtics won, that would do nothing for my life. Like it's in the East. I never faced that team. Granted, I'd have to hear Bill be obnoxious for a while, but like,
that's a big factor.
I don't think it would do anything to Tatum's hobby value. I don't think it would really like do much of anything to the Celtics players. Like I just want status quo if it's not going to be my teams.
Yep. Yeah, or like a totally random team. Right?
Yeah.
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 Just like not going to pick it.
But
right, well, I do have somebody that I root for a little bit that I realized when I pulled up the standings, which is Jimmy Butler and the Heat. So that would be my pick for the positive.
Did you hear Bill's take on the Heat today? He's like, are they good? He's like, he's doing it again.
He's like, this year it's going to be different. I'm telling you guys.
They suck this year.
They're not the Michael Myers Heat anymore. But he is like a little bit onto something because by this time of the year, Butler is usually really ramping up and he's not.
Yeah. And their metrics are bad. They're like in the 20s of all the stats, all the categories.
Yeah. He's going to be like the economist who predicted 9 of the last 2 recessions. He's finally
going to go. I'm trying to think of another team that I kind of enjoy. Boston, you know what? The random team is probably the Magic. It's just so random.
Perfect. Like, yeah.
They got a young squad. There's nobody I can really hate on that team.
Yep.
They don't have any media attention.
There would be some crazy Banchero stuff. Maybe Banchero should annoy you a little bit just because he's getting LeBron comparisons and it's ridiculous to compare him to LeBron.
It's fine. There's no way. The one that would annoy me the most. All right, let's go to the ones we want the least.
Oh, see, this. How long do we have? I have so many. I could just go down the standings and give you the reason.
Mine's probably the Timberwolves because I just couldn't hear the Edwards stuff.
Like, that's a very high one for me. Is if and when my teams get knocked up, I'll be rooting against the Timberwolves just for the Anthony Edwards hype that would follow.
The Warriors, I need them to lose immediately. Like, I want them to not even make it. Just get knocked out and play in.
I'm not as worried about the Warriors, but I can respect that. I can definitely respect
you gotta be consistent with the hate on the Warriors. You can't deviate. You got to be focused. You got to always be watching them.
No, I totally get it. Then the Thunder, just because I wouldn't want to hear all the SGA hype that follows. So they're up there for me. And that's about it for the West. I don't mind if Kawhi and Harden and Westbrook and Paul George get a title. I think that'd be fun.
South can
have nothing.
You have something to be happy about.
South would be on cloud 9 for a long time. His Instagram stories were turned so like happy and positive for a few weeks there.
Yeah.
And I don't really like the Pelican. Like, there's a lot, everybody else in the West. I'm neutral on, and then in the East, I would be rooting against the Bucks.
Yeah, I can't hear the Giannis stuff and the Dame. They're not going to, though. That's the thing. Like, Doc will find a way to blow it.
Yep. I would definitely be rooting against the Bucks. I would be rooting against the Knicks. I would be rooting for the Pacers. I like the Pacers. And I'd be okay with the 76ers. I'd be okay with that.
So you're happy? You're happy with the 5, 6, 7, 8 seeds, basically.
Yeah. Fair. Yep. All right. Good. With still plenty of time here before the playoffs even start, but fun question. All right. From JP Zidane 1, what do you think about the long-term trajectory of the hobby? What inning are we in? No, I'm just kidding. In the 90s, all of my friends collected cards. We stopped in our late tweens. Or maybe I mistyped that. Did that say tweens? We stopped in our late tweens, and I was the only one to get back into it later in life. Now, much fewer kids collect than in the 90s, and I feel like that does not bode well for the hobby in 20-plus years. What do you think can help make cards more popular among kids?
Man, I don't think hold on one second. Turn this thing off. This is a good question, because I feel like everyone is just trying to will the hobby into this, like, let's 10x everything, let's do this. What if we just, you know, what if we just sort of glide along where we're at right now for a long time? Like, people need to maybe figure out how to deal with that reality, you know?
Yeah, they do. That's a really good point. It's a good good thing to keep in mind that, like, is it worth getting dejected over if the hobby doesn't 10x?
Exactly. Like, you need to plan for that, because it just seems like maybe people are jumping back in, buying with the assumption that it's going to 10x with Fanatics taking over, or it's going to, you know, they're looking forward to some event, but maybe this is just what the hobby is. It's still like a niche thing. Like, you know, we don't have that many friends around us that are, to the question asker's point, that are still doing this or have come back.
Yeah. Ankesh says more kids collect now than in the 2000s. So are we doomed now? So, like, that's a point. That's kind of where I would lean if I were to take the side of giving a rosy outlook.
Yeah.
I would say, like, are fewer kids collecting now than in the 90s? Is that like 100% for sure? It might be.
There's probably more kids involved. I guess I'd be more concerned about, like, the hyper focus from a large percentage of the community being focused on the gambling aspect and the breaking and the repacking and that kind of thing.
Yeah, because when I was thinking about this question a little bit, I looked up what the population was of the United States in, like, 1992, 1995, and what it is today. There's about 100 million more people today,
yeah,
in general, than there was in the 90s.
Yeah.
And there's probably going to be another 100 million or more in another 20 years.
Did you feel like when you were a kid that everyone was collecting?
No.
Me either. Like, I remember there were certain groups, like, Pokemon, and, like, so there were some, like, Yu-Gi-Oh stuff. I remember some sports, but it was never, like, I think people get it confused that with the Beckett magazines and, like, the memory of the excitement of it, that, like, everyone collected and it was this huge, massive thing. I remember a lot of people doing Pokemon, but it wasn't, like, and I hear of a lot of kids today that do it. People message me and, hey, my son's getting into it. What do you think? Stuff like that.
Yeah. I remember lots of people sort of having a really brief dabble with it because, like, somebody gave them a pack for a birthday or something, and they just kind of, like, had some stuff. Maybe they were into it for, like, 6 months or something. But I think there's always been a low percentage of people who really dive in and get into it among those who are exposed to it. So, I don't know. I think that's a factor. It is good, too, to be thinking about the long-term trajectory here. The thing about the 90s for me, I don't remember many, if any, kids that I went to school with having cards. I don't ever remember, like, bringing my binder to class. I don't ever remember talking to people from my school about it. I don't know anybody that I went to school with today who got back into cards. I don't remember any of that. I do remember, though, feeling like there was a card shop on every block.
Yeah.
I do remember that. I remember feeling like there was so many cards. There was one within a bicycle ride from my house that I would like to go to. It's about a mile away.
You know those, I don't know what they're called, but, like, the little setups in the middle of the mall, not, like, the outlet parts, not to the outer parts of the mall, but, like, know what I'm talking about? I don't know what to call those.
Yeah, kiosks.
Yeah. I remember when I was a kid, the mall by me had a, like two or three of those were dedicated to sports cards. And then there was also like a dedicated store inside the mall. I do remember that.
Yep. All right. Carbon says the key is to get kids into collecting, period. It doesn't matter what it is. It's then what they like, they will start collecting. So it's up to the leagues and the athletes to promote the game to kids. Yeah. Fair.
That gets the like future generations kind of keeping it rolling.
Definitely. All right. Anything else on that, on the long-term trajectory of the hobby, or concerns that no one's going to be around to collect these cards in 20 years?
We don't have that. I'll just keep going back to the Mickey Mantle example. Like, people are still buying Mickey Mantle. Like, there's going to be people buying MJ and LeBron 20 years from now. It's just the reality of it. There's so many people that have ties to it, and future generations are going to keep it going and stuff. I guess my final thing is, like, I just don't want to get so tied up in the numbers of this 10xing thing. Like, I feel like it's just the forced nature of it is what gets us into this trouble, versus like just focusing on enjoying what you have now, and then it kind of letting it like organically get to that point. And we look up 5 years from now, it's like, oh wow, at 2x, you know, that was an interesting 5 years, versus like we have to get to that now. Because this is the whole, you and I have been talking about this with like the crypto and NFT and the AI. Like, we got to force these things up to 2x in a month, and it just doesn't make any sense. Like, you were reading something about this, right? Like, the more you force it up quicker, the worse it turns out business wise, the hobby, anything financial. It just never turns out better. So it doesn't make any sense.
Absolutely. All right. From Perimeter Collectibles. Got two questions on this card, but we'll take them one at a time. And the first one is, what is your take on the Barry Sanders PMG Gem Masters hitting the auction block? For some reason, I got a physical image of a card just like flying into a block. Just a year or two ago, the previous owner was still spending millions on cards and expressing his bullish sentiments. Ooh, and now he's selling.
We know who that is?
I think this card once belonged to a piece. I don't know. I'm not sure, so I don't want to speculate and just be wrong. And
yeah.
Let me bring up the image of this card while we think about this question.
I love the design of this one. I never liked these Gem Masters. The basketball ones are better.
Yeah, I agree with that.
It's like a bronze color, isn't it?
Yeah, it's got a bronzish color to it, and like, there's this lion in the background. You know, it's something, you know. I mean, I don't know how many playing days 90s is 98 playing days for Barry, actually.
Right towards the end. I think maybe he retired in 99. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it looks like his final season was 1998. So this is a playing days card for Barry. And I don't know how many playing days one of ones he has. It can't be many. And he had a PMG green cell for like $45,000, I want to say, in 2020. Let me just fact check that really quick. Yeah, so he had a PSA 7 PMG green sell for $48,000 in December of 2020. Remember, those were out of 15. And 2020 was 3.5 years ago now, December of 2020.
Wow.
So now this card is obviously going to destroy that. It's already at 120,000.
Wow.
With BP. It's got 12 days to go. So what do you think about the fact that the person who's selling this was bullish in sentiment publicly?
I mean, everyone was bullish in 2021, so that doesn't narrow it down. Everyone's bullish when the market's ripping and everyone's all excited. Oh my god, it's never gonna stop. And then 2 years later, they're dumping everything.
Right. Yep. So that's a good point. And so I guess one way you could interpret it is that the owner isn't bullish anymore.
This card really reminds me of that Duncan, so I feel like I already know your take on the card.
Yeah. I would want to see the difference with Duncan is that Duncan has like three or four Prism Black Plain Days cards and a bunch more post Plain Days, and he's in all the exquisite stuff. He's got top scrum super fractures, he has fine super fractures.
True.
You know, true. He's got a ton of stuff, and he's signing again. He's going to be like appearing in some new products then with signatures. So,
true.
But for Barry, like he's got a lot of post Plain Days cards too, obviously, but, he's in that sort of like Michael Jordan sweet spot where 1998 is that was his last season. So this might be Barry Sanders' best card. I don't know. It might be.
His rookie cards are horrible.
Yeah.
Like super junk wax. There's no way to have an enjoyable Barry Sanders rookie card.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. So I don't know. I'm interested. I guess I'm curious to see where this one's going to end at. Just because, like, 90s stuff, whether it's baseball or basketball or football, is ripping right now.
Yeah, it's all on fire.
Yeah. And the question that I think about there is has it entered, like, 52 tops baseball territory where like we've just got like deep was in the chat saying like 90s guys are now in their 40s and they're approaching their peak earning power. Are we just have we reached a point where like this stuff is gonna settle into a vintage groove, or have we hit a point where like this is a bubble, this is a very highly inflated market and this stuff's gonna correct a lot?
Yeah,
and I could see it going either way.
Yeah, I was gonna say it feels a little bit like a little bit of both. Like it'll probably correct and then go back up and stabilize and turn into vintage over time. People are probably still trying to figure out like exactly. I mean, we basically know it's like the PMGs and rubies and the green PMGs and the gem masters. Like we know the ones that are gonna stand out over time, but there does seem to be a bit of a battle in that middle layer and confusion around which inserts are the best ones. Do I focus on PSA 10 inserts or do I do the best inserts, you know? So there's a little bit of confusion around that stuff.
Okay, that is a super interesting question point there. And I just want to say too, like even if something enters into a vintage, it gets sort of seen like as vintage, I guess, or Mickey Mantle cards, for example, his index on Card Ladder, which has 544 cards in it, that index is down 13% over the last 2 years. And it's down about 20% off of its peak. So even in the case of a Mantle, if the investors target it and want to push it and see how far they can make it rip, then it can correct just the same as anything else.
Yeah.
Okay, now you were saying something there about people are still figuring out what stuff from the 90s they want to collect.
Yeah, I mean, like, if you think about, you're telling, if someone is like, hey, I want to jump into vintage long term, and I'm, you know, I like the cards and I like Mickey Mantle, what should I do? 51 Bowman, 52 tops, 53 tops, 54 tops. It's really easy. If someone comes to you and they're like, I want to buy a 90s basketball, it's like, it's a little bit more complicated. And obviously, that even gets more complicated as you get into the tops and Upper Deck and Panini eras. Like this is definitely the biggest gap right now is people understanding like what is going to be the stuff that holds up over time. Vintage is easier to pinpoint because there's just less stuff, but if you're when we're getting into 90s, I get a little bit more hesitant.
Yeah, there were periods of time in the 90s where, you know, there were dozens and dozens of products coming out in the various sports. So like I think for football, I was looking at this a few months ago, so like let's just pick a year, but let's pick 1998 for football. I mean, here's all the products that came out for 1998 football, right? From 1998 Bowman Chrome, Bowman's Best, Collector's Edge, Pacific Playoff,
yeah,
Score, Skybox, SP, SPX, Tops, a bunch of Upper Decks, and you've got all the oddball and the collegiate stuff too. You know, that's 1998.
Yeah.
That's the year that this Barry card came.
Makes too many cards, right?
What's that?
I thought Panini makes too many cards, right?
Yeah. Panini, there were more football sets in the late 90s than there ever have been during the Panini era.
Yeah. That's, I mean, like, I'll see, like, a random Jordan insert PSA 10, and it's like, you'll hear from guys like, oh, this one's undervalued, it's super important, you need this one, and it's like the 38th ranked insert of MJ. You know, like, where do you draw the line of what you focus on? Because over the last couple of years, you and I have been really focused on consolidating down, moving up, getting like the specific ones, like trying to understand the top cards that you should be, that we want to go after based on, you know, all these factors. In 90s, it's not that easy. It's not easy. You have to really know what you're doing.
Yeah. And like, it gets even more complicated if the player that you like and you're collecting from the 90s doesn't have rookie cards in the 90s.
Yes.
So then it's like if you're like a Bird and a Magic guy or a Ken Griffey Jr. guy, you know, and you're collecting maybe PMGs of Griffey or something, or, you know, refractors of Jordan, and then you have to be able to have a theory of collecting that explains why you're focusing on this niche of cards to the exclusion of rookies, you know, to the exclusion of early career cards, stuff like that. So
yeah, like that Duncan PMG was a second year the Gem Master.
Yep.
His green PMG is technically a rookie.
Yep.
But we don't think of those, that era of cards, as being rookie cards because of MJ and, you know, Shaq and all these guys, where their rookie years were during eras where those cards are just so overprinted and we don't even really consider them. So it's a really interesting little window there that you pointed out.
Yeah. And I have, the Panini era really makes you think about this, because even though Panini offers less products for ultra modern collectors, they have way more sets.
Yeah.
So I can like go into 2022-23 NBA Flawless, there's probably 20 insert sets. there's probably, you know, however many parallels. And that's a big difference, is that it may be one product, but it has the equivalent of five products worth of cards as compared to the 90s. And because of that, Panini makes it, you know, collecting Panini has made me really want to figure out what are the 10 best cards of a player's. And they're all going to be from the rookie season in most cases. And then when you eventually start thinking that way, and it inevitably reflects back onto collecting 90s, and I think there are a few things that 90s collectors can learn from ultra-modern collectors and vice versa. One of the things that they can learn from the ultra-modern era is how to really pinpoint in on what significance is for a player's catalog. And the path that led me down was a very heightened appreciation for the Playing Days one of one Michael Jordan cards. And those are cards that don't get any play in discussions about Michael Jordan cards. Like, and it's understandable. Like, when we're talking Michael Jordan cards, we'll talk about the best inserts. This insert's the best looking one. I love Golden Touch. This guy loves A Cut Above. The other guy loves Rave Reviews. These guys love Big Men on Court. And like, I like this one better. The design's better. This one's rarer. This one has a lower pop report. And these are all amazing discussions, and it's great. But I never hear a discussion about, you know, the 1997 Flair Showcase Legacy Collection Masterpiece One of Ones. And those cards to me are, well, unfortunately, Nat has three of them. So the only one he doesn't have is the Road 3. But those are truly, if an ultra modern collector would go back and look at Jordan's offering and pinpoint those.
Yeah. Remember that video where the guy had like all those all together and he graded them all BGS authentic with a blue label?
Yeah, Ted Yates.
That was ridiculous. That was one of the most ridiculous videos.
That video was awesome. Yeah. That video was, it's still fun to go back and look at that video. But that video also was so irritating now because I bought one of his cards in 2021 that he sold from eBay. I bought one of those.
Dang.
And then he like kept sending more to the market after I bought mine. And so, you know, the guy just like unleashed a tidal wave of those legacies. But I think the Cajun Cardboard did a great job of undertaking the task and identifying the task of creating a hierarchy. And I think everybody would do it differently. So whether you one agrees with his opinion or not, fine. But I think the task of identifying a hierarchy is a really, really, really useful thought experiment. And it's a lot harder than it might seem. So, all right. The next question on the Barry from Drake is that the Barry Sanders PMG Gem Masters 1/1 is already over 100K, only 24 hours after the auction began. My question, I understand people placing bids early on eBay so you can get a reminder close to the end of the auction. But when your bidding format is one like PWCC Premier, why do you think people place so many early bids instead of just watching the card and waiting until extended bidding? Is it an effort to drive up the price? Is it an effort to keep other people from bidding? Are a bunch of people truly placing their maximum bids early, or is it something else?
Oh, it's usually people protecting their other cards, defensive bidding. Like, I don't wait. If you actually wanted that card, why would you bid on it now? It makes no sense.
Yep.
You don't even need to do... PWCC no longer even requires that you bid before extended. That's not even a thing anymore. They completely eliminated that.
That's a great point. Yeah. I think that's the most common answer usually here. And I'll say this, too. I know that no consigner will ever heed this advice, but... I can say that as a buyer, I bought one card ever from PWCC Premier. And the thing that lured me in, I think, and that kept me like really going was that the card that I was interested in, I thought was amazing. And it was really, really low.
Bingo.
Going into extended bidding.
Bingo.
And so I was hooked and I was like, I'm going to get this card for a great price. And then, you know, as the night rolls on and as the extended bidding rolls on, and it keeps ticking up, and I'm obviously going against at least one other person, maybe a few others. Now I'm kind of committed to winning this card.
Yep.
And I admit that card may not even have garnered a single bid from me if it was already at 80% of its final price prior to entering extended bid.
I agree. It's actually backfiring on the strategy of the defensive bidder. It's actually potentially harming it. I 100% agree. I remember when that one was going, it was at like 10K, 8K for a while. I was like, dude, this is amazing.
Yeah.
And then I saw when it ended, I was like, well, there's no way Chris won because I know what he was looking at and what he was talking about, and you won it. And I was like, wait,
yeah. You
went up all that way? And just now getting a look behind the curtain, it's like, yeah, because you were excited and you were involved and you had this interest in it that night that you just rode the wave versus... Yeah. If that thing was at 40K going into the night, you wouldn't have even looked at it.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
We also, that night, the two of us kept setting new budgets. Like, Chris would be like, okay, here's our max. And then I'd be like, when it went over that, I'd be like, well, what's the difference between that and, like, this? And then I'd be like, okay, that like this is my budget, and like I'm done here. And then Chris would be like, well, what's between this and whatchamacallit? And like that's also what happened.
Yeah.
If it goes to 40, you as an individual and you two are not going through any of those conversations because you're already like, well, like it's already at 40 and I haven't even like sat down to think about it. I don't even want to.
That's so right. And like, or maybe here's an analogy. Maybe it's not perfect, but isn't it so much more engaging, and doesn't it command your attention and gather an emotional investment from you so much more if you're watching like a back and forth game? And
yeah.
Then you're, you know, it's close and you know, you don't really know, and you're engaged the whole time. It's a lot more fun to watch your team win a competitive game than it is to just turn it on, they're up 30 and then it's over. There's just something to that, I think. There's something to dangling the chance in front of you and keeping it live for as long as possible.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think defensive bidding happens a lot, and it's not really, I don't think it usually pans out as well as it might if more people felt like they had a chance to win the card up until the final moments.
Yeah, that card felt like it was going to get there regardless, and it's more people involved if it was later in the game. So this, I mean, it's still going to sell for a lot, you know, obviously, but.
For sure. All right. Okay. So good question from Drake. Okay. From Football Card Dude 12. Why is there so much emphasis put on quote unquote valuable cards in the hobby? All of us started out collecting base cards as kids, and not to mention just a few years ago, most of these high-value cards could be purchased for many multiples cheaper.
Mm. This question comes up every so often. I don't really ever have a good answer.
I think, like, to take the question at its face value, why is there so much emphasis put on value? And it's because it's the same reason why it's the same reason why content will go viral if somebody wins the $50 million Powerball, but somebody wins the $500 scratch off at the gas station. It's not as exciting.
Yeah.
Or it's the same reason why if somebody makes a parlay that pays out $500,000, it drives way more engagement than somebody who hit the parlay that paid out $200. You know, people are fascinated by money. So,
yeah. Well, if you're calculating all the factors that make a good sports card, the answer and the outcome is usually the price. Like, this is people figure out how much they want the card. They figure out, like, the desirability, the, you know, prestige of the card, the year it was made, whether it's rookie, all these different things go into these calculations of how much I'm going to pay. So it usually ends up that the more expensive a card is, you know, the more people want it, the better it is, the better features it has. So, like, we end up talking about the best, which happens to usually be the most expensive. It's the same reason we don't talk about the Wizards and the Pistons, but instead we talk about the best. Like, usually us teams are drawn to the best.
Yeah. I think these are all like parts of the answer, but even though there is an answer and the answer is reasonable within the context of how people behave generally, it doesn't change the fact that there is a level of crudeness to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's sort of this like lingering idea that measuring anything by its financial value, whether it's a card or by extension the person who's able to purchase the card, that there's something repugnant about that. And I think that's always a valid point of view. I think that's always something worth reflecting on, is that we can always put less emphasis on value and be just fine. So
even if we did that and we didn't talk about value, we only talked about all these other features of the card, the output is still the value of what you pay for it. You know what I mean? Like, you just can't avoid the answer to the formula.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, it's just always been, I guess, you know, maybe a different way to frame it is one of the things that some people do like about cards, or one of the perks of it, is that it is less of a taboo to display and show off valuable cards. Whereas it would be much more inappropriate in the eyes of most people to, like, just have an Instagram page dedicated to your pay stub that comes.
Yeah.
Although maybe those will be graded soon.
Well, the reason for that, and the reason that, you know, like, showing off the super expensive cards is more impressive than just showing a pay stub is even if you are super rich, a lot of the cards that we respect as hobbyists are not, like, easy to get even if you have money. So there is still some level of skill and networking and communication that has to be put in place and some actual, like, passion to be able to really get some of this stuff. So that's why, you know, we usually respond pretty well as a hobby to expensive cards. It's like, oh, shoot. Yeah, that dude's rich, but that was not easy to get that card.
Yep. Very, very true. And I guess, like, the final thought that I have on this for now is that there are great cards that I put emphasis on when I see them show up on somebody else's page or see them show up at auction or whatever, that aren't anywhere near the most valuable, but that are still really cool to look at, to think about. And you know what? A one of one of Rajon Rondo is just as rare as a one of one of Kobe Bryant's.
Rajon Rondo taking strays? Come on, man. He's the smartest basketball player of all time. Don't you listen to these player podcasts?
No, I don't. Absolutely do not.
I forgot what I was going to say. That's funny, though. Rajon Rondo taking strays.
Yeah. So, like, a great card is a great card. There's the player on the card, but great card is still a great card.
Oh, I saw a status kaleidoscope one of one in person the other day. Have you seen one of those?
I have.
I think you had a shot at one of those once. Did you end up?
I had a shot at the Luka rookie one and I missed it, but I do have a Jokic non-rookie Kaleido from status.
2018?
2017.
Yeah, those are sick, man, and they're cheap. It's like, there's definitely cards where I'm like, dang, these are really sweet cards. But usually the conversation turns into, like, this card's undervalued. Like, it turns into, I'm trying to make it more valuable anyways by what I say.
Yeah, and it's almost inevitable.
Yeah.
It's almost inevitable that it's going to happen that way. Because if you see something desirable that other people don't see as desirable, or that we're unaware of, and then they come to see it as desirable too, all of a sudden their wallets are opening up now to try and get it as well. And you've increased demand, you've created more demand for something. So, all right. Next up here is from Pac Nicholson. If you save an image of a packing slip on your phone, you can click the tracking number in the picture. Which, by the way, we've had this revelation on the show.
Okay. I don't think this is an Android thing because I don't know if I can do that.
What?
I don't think I've. Okay. I'll try it. I'll try it next time.
Okay. Well, anyway, so if you can save the image of a packing slip, you can click the tracking number and it will automatically pull it up. This does work. Does this information change your preference of getting sent the actual tracking number versus a picture? And then this works on iPhone, but I don't know about Android. So I guess what he's saying is, if somebody sends you the picture, then you can just tap the screen
and
grab the you can grab the tracking number for yourself.
Yeah, my biggest pet peeve is when you send a text message or an Instagram message and it has, like, oh, I sent the card for you. Here's the tracking, and the tracking's in that same message. Mm. So you hit enter, and then you paste the second. You know what I'm saying?
Yep, 100%.
I have to copy it and delete and all this crap.
Yep. Same thing with, like, sending an email address or something like that, too.
Yes, always do those. Dang, There you go. It's all in bubble. Perfect.
Sometimes I purposefully put the email in the same message because I don't actually want the person to email me. I'm going to make this as difficult as possible for you to contact me to see how much you want.
That's big brain stuff right there.
That's 75D chess.
That's passing the player open.
I know what Pat Nicholson is getting at here. He's saying, you know what, if I take the picture of the receipt and I send it to you, what's the difference if I'm the one who pushes and holds or you are? That's what he's saying. I think that's what he's driving at.
That's like,
you know what?
That's like saying, it's okay, I'll send you the voice message. You know, I have to hear, no, it's not the same.
I'm going against this. I'm railing against this. If I'm the seller, I'm taking the final step, and I'm going to gather that tracking number, and I'm going to put it in its own bubble, and I'm going to send it through.
Yeah, agreed. As a seller, I feel like we should have a really concise set of minimum steps, and it's that you're very quick to communicate what's going on. You're communicating when you plan to ship, what sort of shipping service you're using. You take a picture as you're packing it to ensure, so they know you're doing it right now. Once you finish, take a picture of the package, let them know you're going to go drop it off in the morning, then type out the tracking number as its own bubble. Like, these are just things that make the buyer feel much better about everything. And I don't know, every time I run into a seller that does all those steps, it makes me feel better about the purchase. So
that's a big point too, man. Anything to increase the level of confidence that the transaction is going to go smoothly is for the better.
Yep.
All right. From 1956 Top Scott, do you store images of your cards other than on Instagram? How do you enjoy your cards rolling?
Well, this is easy. Card ladder collection.
Yeah, I actually strongly prefer, if I'm going to look at my cards, I'm going to look at them on my collection feature on CardLadder. I'm not pulling them up on Instagram. Number one, because when I pull them up on CardLadder, I can get a giant image of just the scan or of the card itself. And on Instagram, I have to look at like the comments and like pinch and zoom if I want to look just the card, but also I can order them however I see fit, and I can, like, it wasn't until I had a card ladder collection feature that I decided to take to sit down and take the time to scan every single card that I had, which now, like, most of the grading companies give you scans of your cards, so you don't even need to do that anymore. But that was a really fun process of scanning everything, putting it into the collection. And then, yeah, that's how I enjoy it too.
Yeah, I do it I like to look at my collection like this, this format, because this makes it feel like I'm looking at it in like a Flickr or Instagram or like some sort of gallery view. And it completely obfuscates like numbers and stats and value. And it just really lets me focus on enjoying my collection. And if I like zoom out enough, you can see 6 cards per row instead of 4. If I zoom in, I can get 3 and 2. And if I click, I can get stats, or I can switch. This is like definitely me shilling for a card ladder, but I built it this way because as a collector, that's how I like to enjoy it.
Exactly. Yep. That's by far my favorite way as well. All right. From J. Duke Cards 2. do you have any advice on taking pictures without my sausage fingers and large head reflecting in the plane?
Have you had this problem? I have. It's hard.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like if you blast a light at it, it just like makes the reflection stronger. It's usually that I angle it a little bit. Like I angle my phone and I step back a little bit. That usually helps. That's like my only trick I have.
Yeah. And there are just some rooms and some lights that work if you catch it at the right angle. And there's some that just don't. Most don't. I find natural light is not friendly to me in most cases. I think that taking good pictures of cards is a really underrated skill. And like when you come across a really nice picture of a card, you should appreciate what you're looking at,
right,
and know that it could have taken even hours.
Here's me just hanging out with my card. No, here's me spending 3 hours trying to get the absolute perfect photo, and you're seeing the output.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so this is a funny story for this topic. Just jotting down title here. Okay.
Natural light, not easy. It could seem like you're talking about like your skin or something.
Well, it applies there too. This is a post that Stiffarm Wax made when he started rolling out his Gridiron Kings. And what one wonders, is this a scan? Is this a photograph? What is this exactly? And then he put his hand on the backside to let you know that this was not a scan, but
yeah,
he took the photo, which is when you get into the nuance of card photography, there is a point of pride in making it a photograph as opposed to a scan.
Yeah.
Because so many times you're going to get that big head reflecting back. So, yeah, when I see a well-photographed card, yeah, I know what I'm looking at.
I think that there's it would be a really cool service that you could like either fly out to someone or they fly to you, where they document and record and take pictures like Stiff did there. I would pay for that. To someone to document my collection, make each picture look that amazing and go through and like make a video about it, or somehow like document like my thoughts on the collection. I don't know. I think I would. I don't know. Let's take some sort of white glove service, you know, where it's cool. Just if you could produce a digital scrapbook of my whole collection at that moment, I think that'd be really sweet. I would. I'm gearing up for something like that now. Like I'm kind of like getting my collection all PSA-ified and getting it all organized and clean and getting the years ticked off and having all the different sets and everything. Like that would be sweet. Because if just looking at that picture from Stiff, I'm like, dude, I need to get Stiff to do that for me for every one of them.
Yeah, I know.
I'd pay for that.
Yeah. Yep. And like the time that goes into that process of like picking out which cards and getting them all lined up in the same slabs and pruning and trimming, and that's a big part of the fun of collecting.
Yeah.
Like, and it's a process, and it's work, and you have to think, but the joy of that process is big. It's a big, but there's also a cheap available. There's a hack to this whole process too, and the hack is the Epson scan. So the Epson scan is a way to get a really nice looking picture or image of your card. It's not going to be quite as nice as if somebody takes a really nice picture of it. The light's not going to be as nice and stuff, but that's the cheat. That's the cheat code to this. And I have availed myself of it for many years. Just take a nice, just get a nice scan and you'll be pretty good. And I like pages, like Instagram pages that are just all consistent scans. I think those present pretty nicely.
Thanks.
So, all right. Binkdit says, do you think that breakers and repackers are here to stay? Or will there be a point where customers eventually just lose so much money that the industry dies. Well, gamblers. Well, what's that?
No, go ahead and finish it.
Gamblers will always love to gamble, but it seems like the rate of loss and repacks in particular far exceeds traditional gambling loss rates slash juice.
Yes. Yes, that last part. I was going to make a joke about how, like, well, Vegas keeps getting bigger and they keep knocking down casinos and rebuilding them even fancier than before. So, like, the gamblers keep on coming. But there is a fine line, though. Like, you're not going to win in Vegas, but I feel like a lot of the games try to keep it at, like, 40 to 45% just to keep it where like, you have a glimmer of hope. If these repacks are at, like, 30% and stuff like that, eventually, you know, you're just going to, I don't know. I don't know the mind of a gambler that well, but maybe I'm talking out of my ass, but I feel like you got to be a little careful with the numbers there.
Right. Yeah. That this, there's a few different parts to this, and it's a good, smart question. That's something that I think everybody should constantly be thinking about. And it's hard for us to answer this because we don't buy repacks. And we don't sell them, and we don't do anything with repacks. So it's hard to get inside the mentality there.
Yet.
Yeah.
There's no break.
We don't break. We don't buy into breaks.
Hard letter repacks.
So it's really requires sort of thinking outside of the box a little bit for us. But the first thing that I would pick at a few things here, and the first one would be, does it is the rate of loss better in straight in, you know, gambling at a casino or in sports betting? I'll tell you this, almost every time in over the course of my life I've gone to a casino, I've exhausted every dollar before I'm done. There's been a few times when I've been with you when, you know, we pull the plug, you know, maybe it's like 1 a.m. and we're cooking at the craps table, or when, you know, we've got up on blackjack and it's like, all right, let's pull the plug, like, we got ahead, let's go. But that's not the normal experience. The normal experience is when I walk into the casino and whatever my budget is, I'm planning on losing all of it, and I usually do. And I go home with nothing. Zero. I go home with a good – I had a good time, right?
Yeah, it's entertainment.
It's entertainment. It's entertainment. In sports betting, inevitably, my bankroll in the app or whatever goes to zero. Eventually gets there. And it's not even because, you know, it's just because, like, I'm bored and I'm sitting there in a state where I'm allowed to gamble and a game comes on and I haven't done any research or looked into it, or, you know, not looking at models or anything. And I'm just like, yeah, all right, you know, the Bucks and the Warriors are playing and I've watched a quarter and I'm going to put $50 on the Warriors or something. And it just, oh, and then do that enough times and it's all going to be gone. So I don't know that the loss rate, my understanding, my expectation of sports betting or casino gambling is that it's going to zero. With cards, even in repacks or packs, the expectation is it's going to 10%. It's going to something small, but you're going to have, there's going to be some residual thing left for you at the end. There's going to be cards. And then the value of that experience is that then you get to grade those cards and then you get to put them on your Instagram page, or you get to go on Twitter, or you get to make like a buy sell thread post, or you get to build a collection up. And you get to have these things, or you get to do it with your family, with your kids, with your friends. It's an experience, it's an activity, and you end up with things at the end of the day. And maybe if you care enough about the value of those things, and some people don't, then that's fine. But maybe if you do, then eventually you say, well, maybe I should just buy the thing rather than jumping through the hoop to get the thing. So,
plus if there are repackers that are providing a less than stellar product by offering really crappy returns intentionally, they'll just be replaced by someone who has better product and better returns. Like, capitalism will end up winning, and someone will come in and fill that area and build the best rates and have the best outputs, and that'll be the one that people put their money to.
Absolutely. I think the reason why repacks are flourishing probably is because the value proposition for hobby boxes and other manufacturer issued boxes and other configurations is not good.
Yeah.
It's been brutal for the last 4 to 5 years.
I also heard that shop owners and dealers are moving to repack because they're just not getting enough allocation. So they don't have enough to break or be involved in breaking. So they have to find some other means to generate ways to sell their cards.
That's such an interesting point, because there had been, if we can like run with that idea a little bit, there was a concern from a lot of people, I think us included, that if the omnipotent manufacturer controlling all licenses decided to take over all the hobby shops too.
Yeah.
And take over manufacturing and take over grading and take over marketplaces and take over live shopping, and that eventually all those things are just going to become run by bureaucrats and just become these bureaucracies of people whose skill set is keeping their job and climbing the corporate ladder and not entrepreneurship and innovation and developing products. So there was that concern has always been there. And it's so interesting that as the lever of allocation is pulled to decide who gets what product and at what price and how much they have to sell it for and how much information they have to give back in order to be able to sell it, that there's been an entrepreneurial pivot. And the entrepreneurial pivot is, we'll just make our own fucking product.
Bingo.
That's pretty good. It's pretty good.
That was really well laid out. You smoothed over a little bit, like how corporate America sucks, but to move to your greater point, that was very well done.
Well, it was your point. It's so interesting thinking about that.
Yeah. The entrepreneurs being like, fuck all this stuff. I'm not letting Walmart take over. Like, we're still going to have our hobby shops. It's just going to be a little bit different. And some of these guys, like, to their credit, they're packaging them in like neat, exciting ways that people get excited about like, I've heard from people directly that they're like, I know I'm not getting back 100% of the value, but I'm enjoying the process of like the thrill of opening these mystery packs, the way that the person who runs it is very entertaining. Just to your point earlier about Vegas, like I go into these whatnot rooms or these break rooms or whatever and watch this person open these mystery packs that I know I'm probably going to lose, but it's just an entertaining thing for me. And the way that they present the packaging is entertaining and whatever, right? Like, to your point, the entrepreneur is able to like make it exciting in their own way without the need of, you know, having a stock pushed on them and having to go public at IPO.
it's super interesting. All right. And the competition of that will hopefully at some point drive down the price of the boxes, yep, the sealed boxes, and hopefully it will make getting allocation as fair of a process as possible, because of the looming threat of, you don't fairly dole out allocation, people are just going to make their own repack products.
The way that you described all that corporate America stuff, the reason I got so anxious about this like 10x thing, I feel like the only way we could actually 10x is if we make the hobby Walmart. And I don't want that inevitability. I do not want to wear the cards feel like it's coming from this massive corporation that's printing everything, grading, vaulting it for me, tokenizing it, marketplacing it all in one, making it so seamless for the, I'm at the game and I'm on my phone and I watch a sweet dunk and I buy some tokenized thing and it doubles in value because he had the sweet dunk and I can sell in the marketplace. Like, that world is so unappealing to me. I would leave the hobby entirely. Like, that just makes it so boring. And there's no There's no like mystery to finding the rare gem and the, you know, the needle in the haystack. There's no collecting. There's no, it's just all that is gone for me. The hunt for the 90s stuff that I didn't have as a kid and trying to put together these exquisite sets, like all that's just gone. You know what I mean?
100%, man. 100%.
If I wanted to do that, I would just buy NFTs.
Right. Yeah. Completely agree. All right. Moving on. From Vinny Slaverino. He's back.
He's back. Okay, good. So we don't have to send out the the search party's canceled.
Or his captor is... we'll have to...
Okay, how did he start the question?
This is good. It's going to be very important how he opens this here. And just we'll read between the lines and see if we believe this is really
happening. It looks like a guy with like an eye patch or something.
All right. Always enjoy the show. But anybody who's familiar with him, like if somebody had been watching him for a while before they captured him, they would know.
If I were to capture him, that's how I would start the question. So I'm not
exactly. So, all right. Even when I forget to ask a question, parentheses, I need to be better. All right, let's keep going. Intuitively, one might think that the price of a PSA 8.5 would be exactly in the middle of a PSA 8 and a PSA 9 on average and all things being equal. But it seems that PSA 8.5s consistently go for much closer to PSA 8 prices. Why do you think this is? Is a half grade just difficult to process mentally? And more existentially, what value does a half grade provide the markets if it doesn't add the value that it arguably should? Thanks, Vinny.
The PSA 8.5 is a weird, it's just weird. Because they don't have a 9.5, 8.5 is the very first one that has the 0.5. So it's just like a weird no man's land in a card. And I'm always like picturing the grader at PSA that's like, you know what? We give eights, or we give either an 8 or 9 like 95% of the time. This is the 8.5 for sure. It's an 8.5.
Yeah, those are good points. Yeah, because the population of 8.5s is so low.
So low. Plus, don't you think like the value is kind of exponential in that as it approaches the 10? It jumps up quicker. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So it would never actually be halfway between 8 and 8.5. It kind of is following this exponential curve up.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah. So the closer you get to a 10, the larger the difference is between each incremental grade.
Yes.
That makes sense. I've always been a fan of PSA 8.5s.
I knew it. Like the more that I push one way, the more you're like, yes, keep going to me. I'm going the other way.
I don't have any PSA 8.5s now, but I once had one. And maybe that's just a relic of the specialness that the BGS 8.5 once had. Because back in my day, the BGS 8.5 was the lowest silver label.
Yes, yes, yes.
And so the difference between a BGS-8, which got the white label, and the BGS-8.5, which got the silver label, felt like everything. It felt like the BGS-8.5 was somehow the bottom of the premium rung.
Right.
But doesn't work that way anymore.
So. I still think that was a mistake, because now the 8 is basically the same as the 8.5.
Yeah, it's been years, and I haven't gotten used to it. And I like the old way better. And I gave it a chance. I really gave it a chance to grow on.
If you had an 8, would you convert it to a silver label?
No. No.
Just leave the white? Leave the stain on your card?
Yeah, like that is the thing, too. Is like the white labels never look great. But maybe it's just because that's how it was when I came in. So I just got used to it. But
yeah, you're such a... You're such a boomer.
No.
Exactly. You want me to get off your proverbial lawn? You guys don't have a lawn, so you're kind of cornering me here.
I guess we kind of are like the people who have had cards for 10 years or so.
Yeah.
Like, and the card value exploded. But we still just complain all the time. It's kind of like a boomer who like bought a house for 30 grand and it's worth 300 grand now. And
especially like in that Silicon Valley area. I always like laugh at that area because there's like, there are like boomers that bought homes and then like, I'm not selling to these fucking tech people. It's like, well, your house is like 100x. Like, well, maybe I'll sell.
If you twist my arm enough, you can have my $100,000 house for $3 million.
Go to the question about the shitbox. What do you call a car? It's a shitbox.
Okay, yeah. Where is the
one? I got one ready to fire off.
You did. Okay, here we go. From Ryan Bitter. If houses are just shitboxes that take away money from buying more cars, what is the term for a car? And then he made a suggestion. He said, how about glorified meat wagon?
Nope. Get your pen ready.
Okay.
It's the shitmobile.
The shitmobile, yep. Exactly. That's exactly what it is. Jake Roy messaged me and had the idea of shit on wheels.
Can I just picture like a turd with four wheels wedged into the side of it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's good. But the only problem is, and that's, I had that exact same word come to mind.
Why wouldn't it be a gas machine?
Okay. So there we go. So this is the only problem I run into. The problem I run into is that the home is referred to as a shit box because one of its primary functions is taking shit and getting rid of it.
Okay, so we need to think. It's like the carbon dioxide.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So they're like, proceeds with the gas
machine.
The gas machine? Good.
Well, we got electric cars now.
Yeah, but
that's true.
Those are stupid. Stop. Just stop. You can't drive very far without having to, like, recharge.
Refill your tank with gas.
Yep. Yeah. So, like, you got the shit box, which is a box, and the main thing it does is take shit away.
So this is
and
a.
Then you have it's still a box. Still a box.
Well, hear me out on this. I'm gonna stick with shitmobile. It's it's a mobile device. You know, it's a mobile, and it's moving the people holding the shit in their bodies.
Yeah.
It's mobilizing the shit people.
Well, in any event, I do like it better than glorified meat wagon.
Meat wagon's pretty good. You don't need the glorified part. Just call it a meat wagon.
Even the meat wagon, I mean.
Well, the meat is the human.
Yeah, but meat refers to something else sometimes, too.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think we made... We made some progress on that.
Some progress? As if there's like a deadline in a couple weeks for us?
There could be... this. Maybe we'll... I need a week to marinate on this.
Like the official board of analogies for sports cards and is going to come to us and be like, okay, guys, what's the official answer here?
Yeah, yep. Well, yeah. All right. We'll get on. Let's do another fun question while we're at it. From Jeff Rose, Jordans, and more. Always think the show is better than a kick in the behind.
Mm.
Are there any cards where it's like you are Ben Wyatt from Parks and Rec and the card is Little Sebastian? Everyone else loves it and oohs and ahs over it, and you just don't get it.
Have you seen that? Do you know what that's referring to?
Yeah, but I need to look up Little Sebastian. Oh, yeah, the horse. Yeah, okay.
There's like a whole episode where he's like, I just don't get it. Like the whole town is like obsessed with his horse, and he looks at it and he's just like, I don't get it. Like this stupid little horse. And they're like, he'll make fun of it, and everyone gets really pissed at him.
Kaboos.
Okay, that's a good one for Christina.
She said
I got some hate DMs when I came out against the booms.
From who?
People who were no longer in the hobby, surprisingly.
Kaboom is like the once we know you're buying kabooms, we know you're about to leave the hobby in a year.
Okay, just jotting that down. All right. So this is little Sebastian. The best of little Sebastian. And Christina says kabooms. And God, I hate to do this, you know?
Just rattle off a bunch.
It's not even going to be a bunch. It's just going to be one. And I just hate to do it because it doesn't apply to all of them. But even after I got a Shield autograph, I still Panini era, not referring to Exquisite, not referring to 90s, Panini era patch autograph cards. I want to get the hype. They're the highest selling cards. The Logoman autograph cards are the highest selling basketball cards Panini's ever made. The Shield autograph cards are the highest selling football cards Panini's ever made. And I want to get it. I want to be a part of it. And I want to be part of the consensus. I just can't get to it. They are little Sebastian for me.
You like your cards like you like your TVs. Thin and shiny.
Perfect. Perfect. Do you have one?
I like that you went that route instead of like picking an insert set. I like that you went like a big, like looming thing that everyone's like kind of freak out about. Let me think about it. I'll think about it some more.
Okay. All right. It's hard not to go like hog wild on this one. You start naming everything.
Well, you just pick such a good one that I'm jealous, and I now I have to like think of something good.
Thank you. All right. Moving on. From Collectomaniac, with the eclipse coming, are you following this eclipse thing, by the way?
I learned about it like 3 hours ago. My wife is on Amazon buying fucking...
The glasses?
The glasses, yeah. I'm like, what are you doing? She's like, we can't look at it. I'm like, okay, whatever. Isn't that like a 10-second thing?
Where we are, it's going to be like 4 minutes.
4 minutes? God, that's plenty of time to go blind.
Because it's like the real sun, and you still can't look at it, right?
Correct. Correct.
But, okay, so if you're in the, like, totality location, while it is completely blocked by the moon, and there's just a ring around it, you can look directly at it.
Mm.
That's not official advice.
That's
anything I say should not be taken into, it's a joke. Everything I say is a joke and is not advice that anyone should listen to. But I did see doctors saying you could look at it.
Twitter doctors.
Eye doctors, not dentists.
All right. Here's my content contribution to this topic. I saw this graph. The orange indicates Airbnb rentals with an occupancy approaching 100%. Full orange is 100%.
Oh my God.
And you can just see how like everybody who's in the band that's going to be able to see the eclipse well, I guess, as like the Airbnb rentals are just like booked up. But
somebody replied to this on Twitter and said, well, because like the closer the color of the dot is to purple, on the other hand, the closer it is to 10% occupancy for that area. And somebody on Twitter said, well, how come there's so much purple for Airbnbs? Which is a fair question. Like, what does this look like when there's not an eclipse? But yeah, so people are excited about this eclipse. Eye doctors are about to see a boom in their local business.
All right.
Don't look into that eclipse.
I got my answer. Your answer is better, and I can't top it, but.
Fair enough.
Anything sealed. Sealed boxes, sealed cases, sealed packs, graded packs. Okay. I think it's all silly.
Nothing sealed. What about like a card with a Panini seal?
Nope. It can't be any of that stuff. Like they're in like the one touches with the seal over the top?
Exactly.
Nope. I bought a box topper or something. I busted that thing open so quick and I graded it with PSA. It was like, I think is what it was called, referred to on eBay listings. No, thank you.
Nice. I like that. It's good. Okay. Let's move on. Oh, sorry. We didn't really answer the question. The question was, what are some of the best space theme cards?
Jimmy doesn't consider them space theme, but... Skybox Metal.
Yeah, Metal Universe, for sure. How could those not be space themed?
Because some of them aren't space, like it's not
some
consistent.
Okay.
Yeah, like it's not consistent through the whole set. So like Jean has said that she does not consider it space themed.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough. All right. Stiffarm Wax says Nebula Parallels. It's a good one.
Nice. Yeah, that's good.
Yep.
That feels closely related because it's like nebulas and eclipses and stuff like that.
A guy named Beavis Card says Uranus, which is on brand.
That's they always do that joke on All In podcasts, and I never laugh. They always like make Uranus jokes, and I'm like, what are you guys like 5 years old? What the fuck is this? Uranus jokes? Why don't you guys start doing your mom jokes on this show?
And for the record, it's pronounced Uranus.
That sounds worse.
Okay. Then Tiger, this is the last eclipse question. Tiger Jordan 311 says, what is the card equivalent to the solar eclipse that is happening on Monday?
People just like want us to come up with all these different analogies.
Yeah,
this is like
this shit's easy. Like, we're not just machines that spit out these perfect metaphors on command.
I mean, they think this show is like SNL. Like, we're just sitting up here, like, we're busting out all these sketches and making everyone laugh.
Well, all right, so let's break down what the solar eclipse even is. All right, so first of all, it's been captured by a lot of influencers. And it's leading to a lot of short-term rentals of Airbnbs.
It doesn't last very long.
Does not last long, where it's going to be over and forgotten before you know it.
Even this card says Mac Jones Donruss. That's pretty good.
Okay. It's going to blind some people. like that that NFT event.
Like more than zero.
And so I don't know, what's the card equivalent of that? Like, some reason, what's an event that just sort of doesn't happen very often, but it gets people excited in the moment? And gets,
I got
like a card show or something, you know?
I got a pretty funny one.
All right.
It's going to bring back some amazing memories for all of us and some laughs. They might still even exist, you know? The sun might still be up in the sky. Top shot.
Top shot. Okay.
It's gonna,
all right.
Gonna burn some people.
It's gonna burn a few people. True. True. Good. All right. There you go, Tiger Jordan.
Now I have to know if it still exists.
That works. I'm glad to be able to move on. Next question here. Let's do.
Wait, hold on. You have to see this.
All right.
Still in beta. You gotta be shitting me. They're still in beta? It's like 7 years old. How are you still in beta?
You can't really fail if you never leave beta.
That's like one of my pet peeves in tech. When people just slap the beta label on it, it's like, it's gonna suck. So enjoy.
I thought you were going to have the sales volumes pulled up.
No. For Top Shot?
Yeah.
Oh. I wanted to see if their website was still up.
It's still going. It's still going. All right. Here, let's have a little fun here. Okay. So, the highest day of sales, according to Crypto Slam for Top Shot, single day. $48 million, February 22nd, 2021.
In one day.
NBA Top Shot sales volume, $48 million, February 22nd, 2021. What do you think it was yesterday, April 5th?
$48 million was the peak in one day.
Yep.
I remember reading articles where it was like, they did $300 million in revenue in this March of 2021. I'll say like $50,000.
$50,000, okay. The answer is $141,000.
A lot.
Which still seems like a lot, right? That's
like I undershot it. I thought I was like going to be embarrassed. Hi.
You thought you were being too bullish?
No, I was. It's mostly like my lack of faith in humanity. That's my reason for giving that number.
Fair enough. That is a percentage decrease from the peak. Okay, it's not always fair to measure something against the peak.
99.
But that's a percentage increase of 99.7. A decrease, sorry, of 99.7%.
That seems bad.
It does. But I can say this, Top Shot has been kind of like floating around at the $100,000, $150,000 range ever since October of 2022. So it hit a level of stability that probably is what it always should have been at. But there's still people enjoying it out there, clearly.
Yeah.
All right. From Bleecker Street Cards, what year would you want 24K Gold Brilliance, which is a Fleer and Fleer parallel, to have been produced for a second time? So, like, I think the only year they had it was 98, 99. What would you want it to have been produced for a second time? And you cannot say 2003-04.
Well, I wanted it a year earlier so we could have MJ in there.
Yeah, I think that's the... That's the other low-hanging piece of fruit here. Is
because that's
97, 98.
That is like basically famous for not having MJ in it. Right. You know, it's like one of the few of the best '90s stuff that does not have MJ in that era, that year.
It does have Penny Hardaway, right?
Yeah, but it's like crippled Penny Hardaway
in a Suns uniform, maybe.
No, not quite, but. He's got like the knee brace and.
Oh, okay. This is the highest selling Fleer Brilliance card. 1998 Fleer Brilliance, 24 karat gold, card number 70, Kobe Bryant. And this, they're all numbered to 24. And this one sold at one time for $109,000, PSA 7.5.
Have you seen one of those again?
I have. Not.
They are shiny. Very, very clean.
Yeah. I know people like them a lot.
They're cool.
What player do you think is the second highest selling Fleer Brilliance? And it was a PSA 10 that sold. And big hint, it's not basketball.
Oh, shoot. Peyton Manning.
No. It's not football either.
Griffey.
Yes. Ken Griffey Jr., the kid.
Damn. There was a question for us about our favorite baseball player.
Yeah, let's go to that.
You just answered it because that's the only guy I could. I played the Griffey N64 baseball game, and that was Mike's. That was it.
Ken Griffey is a very good example, I think, of the power of people wanting to have a set and then settling for the best player of the era in order to have it,
yep.
Or the most collectible player of the era. Because I think among Michael Jordan collectors in particular, there's a really strong belief that, like, if your era of cards doesn't have a Michael Jordan or a LeBron James or a Kobe, basically, if you don't have one of those three in your set, that set is not going to matter.
Yeah.
Give it enough time. But, you know. But I guess I can't really put this Griffey thing as a like, you could reply to my point and say, well, the only reason the Griffey matters is because it's from an era of 90s that was popularized by players like Jordan and Kobe, but Jordan wasn't in that set. And that's still that PSA 10, by the way, sold for $59,000.
Well,
on eBay. So anyway, all right. To the question about baseball. From Collectomaniac, baseball is back. As guys who don't collect baseball and thus rarely talk about it, unless we're shitting on it, who were some of your favorite baseball players growing up, if you had any?
So my college roommate and I we play this game to this day where we randomly will text each other super random. It has to be random. It can't be like a known player. And a lot of times we'll do baseball or football. Like today, he texted me. All he said was Rashad Jennings. And I replied, Hakeem Nicks. We're just naming like super random. And I'll be like, I'll just text him and be like, Jeff Kent, Ed Renteria. So like, I could name some guys, but I didn't really like, I don't really follow a lot of them in the baseball world.
Okay. Fair enough. Did you play baseball?
No. Never. Never T-ball. Baseball, nothing.
Yeah, I played baseball through part of my high school years.
Whoa.
I was on a traveling team. And I was a pitcher, but I had accuracy problems.
That's not good.
And I was a hitter, but I had problems with my lead foot stepping out of the box. So, cursed on all sides. But I don't remember ever really following MLB, even though I played baseball for a long time and I enjoyed playing it. And I remember 90s baseball being about Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa and Bonds and the home run race and Roger Clemens. I think I liked Roger Clemens because he was a pitcher. That's about all I got.
This guy's calling into question my ability to name random baseball players. How about Marquise Grissom?
I had heard of several of those names. I definitely heard of Jeff Kent. Who was the Hakeem Nicks, you said?
That was a football player.
Yeah, I was going to say, all right, that's probably why I know that.
Well, that was a good one. See, people in the chat can do it. Ben Jarvis, Green Ellis. Just start naming super random guys. It's a pretty fun exercise because you always get a chuckle out of your friend that you text. It's like, oh, I remember I drafted him in the 6th round of my 2012 fantasy football draft.
Nice. All right. From PLB Cards. So we got 3 questions on this. I'll just put them all together. From PLB Cards, let's discuss Zach Edey moving into NCAA basketball GOAT territory and even making an appearance in the card ladder Instagram stories.
Nice.
Mike Pinkerson 50 says, will Edey be able to compete in the NBA? And Cajun Cardboard says, Will Zach Edey's career NBA games be over or under 50?
Oh, man. Well, Juan Pierre, and let's see. I've heard him compared to, this is probably the best comparison I've heard, Luke Garza. Do you remember him?
Yep.
Do you know who that is? He was a National Player of the Year, similar build, kind of like teetering on NBA status. I think he's been in the G League. I think he plays for the Pistons or something, maybe the Timberwolves. He's moved around a bit.
Yep, I think.
I don't know.
Right now.
Hard to project what he's going to be, but that's probably a decent comp.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't watch college basketball. I watched like 5 minutes of him the other day, so.
He's big.
Yeah. It is nice watching people play the post. That's what I enjoyed watching him.
Been a minute since you've seen someone like take more than two dribbles in the post?
Yeah. Yeah, it was like, it's a throwback to, see, I wasn't really passionate about 90s baseball, but man, I loved 90s basketball when I was growing up. I loved the post players. Hakeem, by far, was my favorite, but you had Robinson, you had Shaq, you had Ewing, you had Alonzo Mourning, you had so many great post players.
That explains your affinity for modern day plumbers.
Yeah, exactly. All right. There's no way Johnny Dickshot is the name of a random player, by the way.
I'm not impressed by these random names yet. Moises pretty good. Pokemon the block. That's not random. He played Benjamin Screen Ellis is the best one so far. They want us to just read these names out loud. That's what they want. They're trying to. It's real? It's a real guy?
This can't be right. This can't be right.
Do you want me to say the name?
The name is Johnny Dickshot.
Well, Stiff wants you to search a couple others. I don't know if you should. One of them ends in a Z. I don't think it's real.
Stubby Clap?
Here's what you do. Just to be really sure, Chris, type in the one that Stiff put, but instead of doing a Google search, do it as one word and then put .com and just pray.
No, I'm good on that. Pass. Alright. Dick Trickle is real. He was a race car driver.
I said name random players, not phallic named players.
Oh, look at this. This is great. All right, so you know how Google has the people also search for feature?
Yeah.
Who are searching? Yeah, and if it was like just, oh, you're looking up this player from this old era, John Oscar Dix? I don't know what the. I mean, anyway, here's the. Here, people also search for Dick Paul.
Oh, he's real. Look, he's right there. That's the one that he does.
Cannonball Titcomb.
What? You gotta click that second one. That's the one that's different that I didn't believe.
And don't sleep on Pete LeCocq either.
It's the first one? Hold on. I can't. We couldn't see that first one. What the fuck? How is that real? It's like it ends in a Z. It just makes it so unbelievable.
Cannonball Titcomb.
What was the first one? It's something pole.
Yeah, Dick Pole.
How come these are all baseball players?
The thing that's got me tripped up a little bit is they're saying Johnny Dickshot's real name is John Oscar Dick Sus.
That is sus. Like he was like, you know what? I really want to change my name. It's too weird. I'm going to change it, and it's going to be something way better. Dick Shot. Like, that's worse, dude.
Bill wants me to try Dick Felt. I did put that into Google when you first put it, but it didn't give me any, like, predicted results.
Just go for it, man. .com. He's probably got a website.
Yeah, I knew Bill would never lead me wrong. Dick Felt.
How is this real? Dick Trickle?
Oh. that's so awesome.
Google is like, you AI people are so wrong. Google's king.
Oh, yeah. Can we talk about AI briefly?
Sure. Is it dead yet?
That's a great story.
Oh, dude. You mean the Facebook or the Amazon store?
Yes.
Yeah, just read that. Let the people know, because that article is not getting much play.
It's not getting enough play.
You know why? Because the Wall Street money doesn't want you to know.
That's right. All right, so...
Founders hate it.
Amazon's just walk out technology. This is from the Washington Times. Amazon's just walk out technology at its fresh grocery stores was touted as being powered by artificial intelligence. All right, so have you had experience with Amazon Fresh and the just walk out technology?
Yes, I was in Seattle and I went into one of those stores just to see what it was like. Bought, grabbed two things, walked out, and then it, you know, alerted my phone that it charged my credit card and everything, and it worked. And it was probably like 30 seconds after I walked out of the store.
Okay. So the idea is like you walk into a grocery store, you pick up things, you don't have to wait in line because the magical powers of artificial intelligence are able to detect what you bought.
It's more like a convenience store, I would say. Okay. It's more like a 7-Eleven because there's not that many items there.
All right. Well, a new report, remember, Fresh, it was touted as being powered by artificial intelligence. A new report says it actually relied heavily on manual monitoring by some 1,000 people in India. Amazon announced this week that it will be bailing on the just walk out checkout technology, which used cameras and sensors to scan each item and shift to the dash cart, a self-checkout shopping alternative. So your artificial intelligence was 1,000 people in India.
Same thing.
And I'm sounding the alarm that many, many things that are being touted as artificial intelligence are anything but. But it's a buzzword, and it's being used to raise billions upon billions from VCs.
I think we should have been dubious from the start. It was like, which we were. I think we talked about this quite a bit in an episode where it was like, because it's being pushed so hard by VCs, this is like the reason I don't believe in it anymore.
Right. Exactly. I'm like, I think there's some idea here that's like, do you remember, did you ever watch this movie, Artificial Intelligence by Steven Spielberg?
No, but I remember it. Jude Law and Haley Joel Osment. Those are some names.
Yep. And the kid was, he was like a robot.
Well,
spoiler.
Wait, is that the one where like,
I think the kid was a robot.
Yeah, the, like, main actor. Yeah, he was. Where the main actor was, like, a sex bot.
Mm.
Not the kid, the other one.
Yeah, I remember.
I think he sees dead people.
It's like, there's, like, this incredible marketing gimmick, bait and switch that's going on right now that's, like, playing on those seeds of what artificial intelligence was that had been planted into pop culture by movies like that and by movies like Terminator. And like, there's a lot of using that imagery and that the notion of these completely autonomous robots that are smarter than humans and also look and act like humans, that this is what artificial intelligence is. And it's not. It's just not. Artificial intelligence is 1,000 people in India. Or it's a language model or it's an algorithm. But we ain't going to be having Haley Joel Osment robots walking around anytime soon.
Oof. Thank God.
All right.
Yeah, that, it was creepy. He was like adopted because they wanted a kid.
Mm.
But then like they didn't want him anymore because he didn't grow up. And it was like, well, duh, you got a freaking robot. Like, he's not a child. Like,
yeah. All right, Josh, this would be... Oh, sorry.
I'll wait for that movie to go on the rewatchables.
Do you listen to the rewatchables?
No.
Okay. Just making sure. I could see Justin listening to that for some reason. Is that way off base?
I don't know. You have to ask him.
Good. Frozen Inferno Collectibles says, will Josh ever get an exquisite Jordan before Shine buys them all?
I had one.
Okay.
Mission accomplished.
Mission accomplished. Those Jordan exquisites ain't cheap. All right. Oh, from Splendid Sports. Let's hit this real quick before we're done. Splendid Sports says, when PSA created their grading standards, was it a good decision to allow for 60-40 centering to qualify for a Gem Mint 10?
I saw this one. That's tough.
That is a tough question.
Yeah, it seems like 55-45 is the sweet spot, but, you know, I don't know. Who am I to... They went with 60-40 to be a little bit more... That's why PSA kind of gets the rap that they're tough on corners and surface, but more leaning on centering. So that's just kind of where it fell. I don't know. It's hard to change it now.
Yeah. Well, I think the market has borne out that people generally do like whatever the standard for the PSA 10 is.
Yeah.
They like it. So, but I do get the spirit of this question, which is, once in a while, there is a card that crops up, you know, on Instagram or on eBay or in an auction, and it's a PSA 10, and the centering is just not great centering.
Yeah.
That does that. I think maybe, this is a speculation here, but I think maybe one of the reasons why was because when those standards were initially created, if you had a card that had outstanding gem mint corners, edges, and surface, the incidence of that in the vintage card world was so low that, okay, we'll forgive 60-40 on the front because relative to the available population, this is such an unlikely specimen.
Yeah. A lot, like most of their grading scale and all the verbiage is, you could tell it's definitely geared towards vintage and isn't updated usually to reflect modern.
Definitely. All right. And we had a paragraph from Brax Ball Cards, but I'll let you decide if you want to hear it or not.
No, we don't have enough time.
Dang, yeah, we ran out of time on that.
We wouldn't have enough time if you asked me that 30 minutes ago.
Yeah, we need a little bit more than 30 to properly analyze that topic from Brax.
Something about like mentors or something. Yep. I checked out after the first set. This is one of those times when you send that text, it's like, good for you, man, or sorry that happened to you.
It's a lot. Maybe he can trim the questions down a little bit. I don't know. There was one from Mike Pinkerton 50, which was sent to the story rather than the post. And it was, who is the best person for the hobby and who is the worst?
Like type of person or like a specific person?
Oh, that's a great, great point. Because that was going to be my sort of reply to this question, is that thinking about the hobby in terms of like who's its best and its worst person is not a productive way to think about what's best and worst for the hobby. And in the hobby, I just don't think it ever helps to make one person a figurehead or a best person or something like that. I think that's not how the hobby works. The hobby isn't an audience and a few entertainers or an audience and a few athletes. In the hobby, everybody's the athlete. Everybody's participating in this hobby. Everybody's a main character in their story. So it's just hard to think of it that way. I don't really think of it that way.
We have to go the other way. It's like collector and then influencer.
Exactly. But if you, and that's why I like what you said about types, because, yeah, in terms of types, the best types are the people who want to be in this for the long haul, who can bring new and interesting ways of thinking about collecting that can make it exciting and challenging and competitive, and people who have a general interest in the well-being of the act of collecting, and who really just take that seriously and prioritize that. And then the worst type of person is just the opposite of that. The person who's just here for a short term, try and rip the market and then bail and leave a cloud of dust or a wake of destruction. And, you know, people who just don't give a shit about anybody else. So
leave a cloud.
How about that?
Leave a cloud of their farts.
From their gas machine?
Exactly.
All right. Let's pick a title.
Yep.
The titles are I'm Not Happy Tonight. Defensive Bidding.
She kind of like stuck her arm out just a little bit though.
Okay. Because I already was so ready to zag on that.
Okay. So yeah. There were so many other bad calls. Like Caitlin Clark pushed off. They didn't call it. There was one where number three on Iowa went to the basket and nobody touched her. They like backed away and they called a foul. There was so many bad calls.
Remember that play? Yeah. The post-game analysis on ESPN, which I stuck around for like 15 minutes, was all about that call.
Right.
And by the time I had consumed 15 minutes of Sue Bird and Diana Taurasi and Scott Van Pelt and the announcing crew, everybody took their turn to be like, to bash the call. I was like, I was ready to zag on that. So,
but it's mostly like I was gearing up to watch a sweet ending and all of a sudden I had to like watch it be over. Like I didn't even get to see an attempted shot. It was lame.
Because it was here's the thing. If that's a moving screen or an illegal screen, Draymond Green would be fouled out within 6 minutes of every game.
Yeah. It's just like it's not really a foul ever and you definitely shouldn't call it there.
Yeah.
I want to watch the players finish the game.
Yeah. Which is the right take. But God, it's already old. It's already a stale take too.
But the ref was like really excited to call that charge. That was so annoying. It's like, oh, you know, they do the charge. It's like, okay, it's a fucking moving screen. Calm down.
Yep. And you know what else was a little striking to me? I don't think I've ever watched coverage of an event, especially like a high-profile sporting event, which was determined by a bad call, which does happen. And there was just like so much emphasis on the bad call.
It was a great game, other than that.
Yeah, I'm just so used to like I've been indoctrinated with the school of thought that goes like there's hundreds of events and hundreds of calls that happen during the course of a game and. Yeah, there's one bad one, but why fixate on that one? There's probably 20 other bad ones that happen at other points. And, you know, like that's any time that I get the inkling to like get upset when a bad call goes against my team or whatever, I'm always like beat over the head with that stick. And I didn't see that stick wield it at all this time.
Hmm.
So. That's something I have to do. That's what I have to figure out. Is like, is it now okay to blame a bad call for the outcome of a game? I don't know.
Yeah, because even like the coach of the team will be like, "We did no. Come on, let me be clear here. We did not lose because of that one play."
right. Exactly. That's the culture and the approach towards officiating that I've been indoctrinated with for as long as I can remember.
Is anyone going to talk about how Caitlin Clark was like kind of bad in that game?
Well,
she was.
Is anyone going to talk about how Geno is like the only coach that has been able to shut Caitlin down?
Yes.
Yeah.
I thought about that too.
But the girl, the Durr, is that her name? Last name D-U-H-R, is that her name?
I don't know.
She was the one that was face guarding her, and she's 2-time Big East Defensive Player of the Year. So they had the right personnel as well.
Yep.
Because usually defensive players of the year in college are, in men's at least, are like bigger players, taller players. So to have like a perimeter player win Defensive Player of the Year means she's pretty good. She was face guarding her the whole fucking game, and they were double teaming on all the pick and rolls, like. Just complete LSU, Angel Reese, she talks all that shit. She's playing drop coverage and going under the screen. She was fucking terrible at playing defense against. Terrible. She talks so much shit. And then she would go under the screen. She would play drop coverage of the free throw line. And then Caitlin Clark would drill a three and she'd throw up her arms like, oh, what the fuck am I supposed to do? You're supposed to get up on the screen. You fucking didn't do it right. And she's like, oh, it's just luck. Throwing up her arms. So annoying.
What do you think the spread is for the championship game, Iowa at South Carolina?
South Carolina.
Well, I guess Carolina, at, but.
South Carolina, 5.5.
6.5.
They're 37-0.
Yeah, it's a pretty big spread.
But this
their money line, -310.
This is what ESPN wanted, though. They just wanted this. Caitlin Clark versus the undefeated team, David versus Goliath. This is what they want. They're so excited.
Oh. Yeah, and that so somebody sent me some propaganda this week that the women's final the Elite Eight game featuring Iowa had like 12-point-something million viewers, and it's more than the last however many NBA finals. True, but not true. All right, true in the sense that the average NBA finals viewership for the last 2 years, I think, has been around like 12-point-something. It's a little bit lower. But the closeout games in both NBA finals were higher than that game.
Single elimination.
Yep. So that's your propaganda corner for the day.
All
right.
Was it a higher rating than all the men's games?
I don't know.
That's the better comparison.
Sure. It is. All right. So anyway, we had I'm not happy tonight. Defensive bidding. Repugnant. Give it its own bubble.
Yes.
What is that reference to?
That's the tracking number.
Oh, yeah.
That's
yeah.
Good.
Yeah. All right. Concise set of minimum steps. Natural lights not friendly to me.
That's so good.
Okay.
Son of a
that big head reflecting back. Make the hobby Walmart. Shitmobile. People who are no longer in the hobby, surprisingly. It's gonna suck, so enjoy.
That's just like a funny caption for this show, because it's like it could be in reference to just watching us. It's gonna suck, so enjoy watching this thing you're about to press play on.
All right, this week I'm not particularly passionate about any of them, and I like quite a few.
I am.
Okay, let's hear it.
The skin making my son, the sun making me look bad. What is that one?
Natural light is not friendly to me.
Yeah, that one.
All right.
Because it's like you're somehow referencing something else.
Yeah, and it's got, even though it wasn't referring to the eclipse, it's got an eclipse vibe.
Yes. And I remember that one time you and Christina went on vacation to a lake and you came back on CrossFit and your feet red.
Yeah. Yep. That did happen.
And it's got the eclipse. Right. I like the eclipse. I feel like we need that. What is it? What day is it?
Monday.
I will be ready. with my glasses.
See you guys soon.
CY CardLadder is the most respected sports card analytics app on the market. We have virtually every card in our system. If the card you are looking for ever sold on one of these platforms, you can find it using CardLadder's sales history. Easily find recent comps and get a better estimate what your cards are worth. CY CardLadder is the most trusted and the most reliable sports card analytics app on the market. We know what you want. Because CardLadder was created by collectors for collectors. Join the innovators, not the imitators. CardLadder, constantly innovating. Try it for free. See why CardLadder is the industry leader in sports card data. CardLadder, we're just getting started.